Imagine this scenario for a second. It's Tuesday night. You wind down, maybe read a few chapters of a book, turn out the lights, you just drift off to sleep. Everything is completely normal.
Right, just a totally average night.
Exactly. But when you wake up Wednesday morning, the world has fundamentally shifted. The alarm clock is ringing, but it sounds, I don't know, distant, keeny, like a cheap speaker that's been blown out.
Yeah.
You sit up, rub your eyes, and realize that on one side of your head, there is just silence. No traffic outside, no birds. You can't hear your partner's voice, just a vacuum.
Or instead of silence, there's this high-pitched scream, like a jet engine that just won't turn off.
It sounds exactly like the opening scene of a psychological horror movie, doesn't it? That immediate total loss of connection to the world.
It really does. But for thousands of people every year, that terrifying silence is a reality. It's not fiction at all.
And that is exactly what we are diving into today, a condition that describes that nightmare scenario perfectly. It's called sudden sensorineural hearing loss, or SSNHL for short.
Sometimes it's called sudden deafness.
Right. And to guide our deep dive today, we're unpacking a really comprehensive presentation by Professor Dr. Ali Dinesh from Florida Atlantic University and Labyrinth Audiology. Our mission here is to sort of demystify this medical emergency.
And Dr. Dinesh really lays out the entire landscape for us. We're going to look at the biological detective work behind it, the incredibly tight window for treatment, and honestly, the fascinating ways the brain tries to recover. But, and this is crucial, if you take away nothing from this deep dive, Dr. Dinesh has one mission-critical message right at the top.
Which is that this is a medical emergency.
Yes, an absolute emergency.
See, that's the part that really stopped me when I was looking through the source material. Because typically, if my ear feels clogged or I can't hear well one morning, my first thought is, oh, it's wax.
Right, or water from the pool.
Exactly. Or maybe I have a cold. My first instinct is always to just wait a few days to see if it pops. It is definitely not rush to the emergency room.
And that instinct, that totally normal human instinct, is exactly what makes this condition so dangerous. Delay is the enemy here. The presentation highlights that this happens within a remarkably short window. We're talking anywhere from a few hours up to 3 days.
Wow.
Yeah, and roughly one-third of patients simply wake up with it, just like in your opening scenario.
So the clock literally starts ticking the moment you open your eyes.
Immediately. Time is hearing. That is the mantra here. The biological window to save that function is incredibly small.
Okay, so before we get into the why, which, spoiler alert, is a massive mystery story in itself, we really need to define the what. Because hearing loss feels like a vague term. If I'm just, having trouble hearing the dialogue on the TV, does that count? How do doctors actually draw the line between a weird ear day and actual sudden sensorineural hearing loss?
It's surprisingly mathematical, actually. It's not just a feeling of being blocked, it's a very specific measurement. Clinicians use what they call the 30 and 3 rule.
The 30 and 3 rule. Break that down for us.
Sure. So to be clinically diagnosed with this specific emergency, a patient has to demonstrate a loss of at least 30 decibels, and that loss has to be across three sequential frequencies on a hearing test.
30 decibels. Put that in context for us. Is that a lot of volume to lose?
It's highly significant. A whisper is roughly 30 decibels. So imagine someone turns a dial and effectively deletes that entire layer of volume from your world.
That's intense.
And remember, it has to be across three different pitches, so low, middle, and high. It's a broad spectrum wipeout of your hearing.
And looking at the symptoms list and the research, it's rarely just the silence, right? It seems like the whole system just goes haywire.
Oh, absolutely. It's a systemic shock to the inner ear. Tinnitus, that ringing, buzzing, or hissing sound we mentioned, is at the very top of the list. Then there's something called oral fullness.
That's that clogged feeling, right? Like when you need to pop your ears on a flight.
Yes, but the terrifying difference here is that no amount of swallowing, yawning, or chewing gum clears it. That pressure just remains. It feels like you have a cotton ball stuffed deep inside your head. And then for many people, there's vertigo.
So dizziness, spinning.
Dizziness, nausea, vomiting. Because remember, your ear isn't just for hearing, it's your body's balance center too.
Who is this hitting, generally? When I think of sudden hearing loss, I maybe unfairly think of the geriatric population. Is this just an aging issue?
Not exclusively, no. And that's a common misconception that actually leads to misdiagnoses. The data shows the most common age range is actually between 30 and 60 years old.
Wow, so working age adults, people right in the prime of their careers.
Precisely. In the US alone, there are about 4,000 new cases reported annually, and the gender split is dead even. Men and women are equally likely to experience it.
Okay.
But here is a fascinating and kind of tricky statistic. In 9 out of 10 cases, it is unilateral, meaning it only hits one ear.
Which brings us right back to the danger of waiting. Because if I lose hearing in just one ear, I can still function. I can hold my phone up to the other ear. I might just think, I'll power through it.
That is precisely the trap. You compensate. You lean in with your good ear. You turn the TV volume up a few notches. And meanwhile, the cells in your inner ear are dying, and that tiny window for effective treatment is slamming shut.
Okay, let's pivot to the detective work. We know what it looks like and feels like. Now I want to get into the causes. Because reading this part of the research felt like an episode of a medical drama. The list of suspects is incredibly long, but the actual culprit is super elusive.
It really is a biological mystery. And honestly, the most frustrating statistic in Dr. Dinesh's presentation is that for the vast majority of patients, the ultimate diagnosis is idiopathic.
Which is just the polite medical term for we have absolutely no idea.
Essentially, yes. Despite there being more than 100 possible causes listed in the medical literature, everything from autoimmune diseases to Lyme disease, only about 10 to 15% of patients ever get a definitive answer of exactly what triggered their loss.
That has to be incredibly difficult for a patient to process. Sitting in the doctor's office hearing, you're deaf in one ear, it's an emergency and we don't know why.
It's devastating.
But for that 10 to 15% where we do have a lead, what are the primary suspects?
Suspect number one is a viral attack. Viral complications are thought to account for nearly 60% of those known cases.
That's a massive chunk. Are we talking about a specific hearing loss virus or just general viral loads?
It can be surprisingly common viruses, the flu, herpes, simplex reactivation, even mumps, though obviously that's rarer now thanks to vaccines. But the mechanism is what's really interesting. The virus doesn't just block the ear with fluid, it causes atrophy of the organ of Corti.
The organ of Corti. Let's make sure we define that clearly for everyone. That's the actual hardware of the ear, right?
Yeah. Think of the inner ear like a grand piano. The cochlea is the wooden body of the piano, but the organ of Corti is the keyboard itself. It's the rows of tiny hair cells that actually detect the sound waves and play the notes to your brain.
So the virus effectively smashes the keys.
Even worse, it makes the keys wither away entirely. If those cells atrophy, the signal never gets sent to the brain. And the presentation specifically notes that mumps is infamous for causing bilateral profound loss, taking out both sides, which is just catastrophic.
So we have viruses destroying the hardware. But I was really taken by the second major theory in the source material, the vascular connection, the idea that this is basically a stroke of the ear.
That is a very apt analogy. We don't often think about it, but the inner ear is an absolute energy hog. It requires a huge amount of oxygen and blood flow to function, but it's supplied by a very specific, very narrow system called the vertebrobacillar system.
High demand, but really narrow supply lines. Sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Exactly. If anything restricts that blood flow, what doctors call ischemia, the hearing shuts down. It's like kinking a garden hose. The water stops instantly. If the blood doesn't flow, the ear doesn't hear.
And this is where the research took a turn that I really didn't expect. There was a specific study cited involving the heart, specifically mitral valve prolapse.
Yes, this is a fascinating piece of the puzzle. Mitral valve prolapse, or MVP, is a heart condition where the valve between the heart's chambers doesn't close perfectly. It's actually somewhat common and often considered pretty benign. But researchers looked at 349 subjects in a study regarding sudden hearing loss.
And correlation was huge, right?
Undeniable. They found that among the patients who suffered from sudden sensorineural hearing loss, 29.1% of them had mitral valve prolapse.
Nearly 30%. That's significant.
It is huge, especially when you compare that to the control group of healthy people, where only 2.7% had MVP.
That's a 10x difference. So connect the dots for me here. How does a slightly floppy heart valve cause sudden deafness in your ear?
The leading theory is microemboli. Tiny microscopic clots can form on that irregular valve in the chest. They break loose, travel up the bloodstream, and usually they're so small they wouldn't cause a major stroke in the brain.
But the arteries feeding the ear are microscopic.
Exactly. So the debris gets stuck in the bottleneck. It blocks the labyrinthine artery, cuts off the oxygen, and boom, sudden silence. It suggests that for a significant chunk of those unknown causes we talked about, the root problem might actually be in the chest, not the ear at all.
That is wild. It really reinforces how interconnected the whole body is. You can't just look at the ear in total isolation.
Absolutely not. And the list of potential triggers just keeps going. The source material mentions ototoxicity, which is literally poisoning the ear with medication. There was a study of over 500 liver transplant patients where 16 developed severe hearing loss, purely attributed to the heavy anti-rejection drugs.
And I saw some lifestyle factors on there too, things you really wouldn't expect, like scuba diving or weightlifting.
Right. Scuba makes sense to most people. We know about the bends or decompression sickness where nitrogen bubbles form in the inner ear fluid. But weight training is the one that always surprises people.
Because of the heavy strain.
It's the internal pressure. If you hold your breath and push really hard, what's called the Valsalva maneuver, you drastically increase your intracranial pressure. If you push too hard, you can actually blow out the delicate membrane window of the inner ear. It's called a paralymphatic fistula. Basically, you spring a physical leak in the inner ear fluid.
Note to self, remember to breathe while lifting heavy objects. Don't be a hero.
Good advice.
Oh, and just to quickly mention, the source also points out genetics playing a role in some cases, specifically mutations of the GJB2 gene, also known as connexin 26.
Yes, genetics are definitely a factor in the broader picture of hearing loss.
So we have viruses, tiny blood clots, heavy medication, physical trauma, and genetics. It's an absolute minefield. But let's play out the scenario. The worst has happened. You wake up, you can't hear, you rush to the doctor. What are the actual chances you get your hearing back?
This is where we get into the prognosis, and the numbers are honestly a bit mixed. It depends heavily on how you define recovery. The source indicates a wait-and-see spontaneous recovery rate, meaning you get better without doing any medical intervention of anywhere from 40 to 70%, usually within 2 weeks.
That actually seems pretty high.
Yeah.
If there's up to a 70% chance it comes back on its own, why this massive medical emergency label? Why not just wait it out?
Because that statistic is deceptive. First off, other studies cited in the same material place spontaneous recovery as low as 25%. That's a huge gamble to take with your senses. But more importantly, the data shows that recovery rates jump significantly up to 50% or higher for full recovery with early diagnosis and treatment. You just don't know if you are in the lucky group or the unlucky group until it's too late.
Are there any clues? Can a doctor look at my chart and tell me if I'm likely to bounce back?
Yes, there are specific prognostic indicators. The actual shape of the hearing test graph matters a lot. If the line slips upward, meaning you've lost the low, deep pitches but kept the high pitches, that's a much better sign than a flat line or a downward slope.
What about the other symptoms we talked about?
Severity matters. The worse the initial loss, the harder the climb back, and vertigo is a very bad sign. If you have that spinning sensation along with the deafness, statistically, your outcome is likely to be worse. It implies a much more extensive damage to the entire inner ear structure, not just the hearing cells.
In age.
Older age generally signals a worse prognosis. The system just doesn't bounce back as easily.
Okay, so let's talk about fighting back. The clock is ticking. The diagnosis is confirmed. What is the doctor's weapon of choice here?
Steroids. Specifically, corticosteroids.
Like prednisone.
Exactly. The goal is simple. Reduce the inflammation. The inner ear is encased in solid bone. It's a tiny, completely rigid box. If the nerve or the tissue swell up inside that box, they get crushed against the bone. Steroids try to calm that storm and reduce the swelling so the cells can breathe again.
And usually you just take a pill for that, right?
Traditionally, yes. Oral steroids are very common. But the source material spends a lot of time discussing a more direct and, frankly, more intense approach. Intratympanic treatment.
Intratympanic. That sounds painful just saying it.
It involves injecting the steroid, usually methylprednisolone, directly through the eardrum into the middle ear.
Whoa. That sounds incredibly invasive. Why would anyone choose a literal needle through the eardrum over just swallowing a pill?
It comes entirely down to biology. The inner ear has a very strong protective barrier, similar to the blood-brain barrier. It is very hard to get drugs from your bloodstream into the ear fluid. To get enough steroid into the ear via a pill, you have to take massive toxic doses that affect your entire body. It spikes your blood sugar, alters your mood, suppresses your immune system.
So the pill is like a carpet bomb, but the needle is a sniper shot.
Precisely. By injecting it directly, you get a much higher concentration of the drug right where it's needed in the paralymph without poisoning the rest of your system. Dr. Dinesh notes that methylprednisolone has the absolute best absorption profile for this specific method. It's about getting the fire extinguisher right to the fire.
Are there other options? I saw something called Carbogen mentioned in the notes.
Yes, Carbogen therapy. It's a bit more experimental or old school, but still relevant. It's a gas mixture the patient inhales. 95% oxygen and 5% carbon dioxide.
Why carbon dioxide? I thought the whole point was getting more oxygen to the ear. Don't we exhale CO2?
We do, but carbon dioxide is a powerful vasodilator. It forces your blood vessels to widen. The idea is that the CO2 blows the doors open, and then the supersaturated oxygen rushes in to feed the starving tissue. It's trying to jumpstart that energy-hungry inner hero we talked about earlier.
I see. There really is a kitchen sink approach here. Throw everything at it and see what sticks.
Sometimes, yes. The material also mentions hyperbaric oxygen chambers, antivirals, vasodilators, diuretics, and even ginkgo biloba as an adjunct therapy, though the evidence and efficacy for some of those vary wildly. But high-dose steroids definitely remain the gold standard.
Okay, let's look at the long term. Let's say the treatment works partially or not at all. The patient is left with some degree of permanent hearing loss. One of the big quality of life issues mentioned was the tinnitus.
Yes, and for many patients, the permanent ringing is actually worse than the silence. Imagine losing your hearing, but having it replaced by a permanent high-pitched scream. Dr. Dinesh cites a study where 5 out of 10 patients chose to use amplification hearing aids specifically to manage the tinnitus.
That seems really counterintuitive.
If
the ear is dead or damaged, does making outside sound louder actually help?
It does, but you have to understand the mechanism. It's called habituation. Think of it like lighting a candle in a pitch-black room. The candle is bright, it's distracting, you literally can't take your eyes off it. But if you walk over and turn on the overhead lights, the candle is still burning, but it becomes basically invisible.
I really like that analogy. So the tinnitus is the candle.
Right. If you are in a silent room because of your deafness, the internal ringing is overwhelming. Hearing aids amplify the environmental sounds, the hum of the fridge, the traffic, the wind. It turns on the overhead lights of your auditory world. This gives the brain something else to focus on, naturally masking the internal ringing.
It essentially drowns out the noise with noise.
In a way, yes. And this leads us to what is probably the most hopeful concept in the entire source material, neuroplasticity.
The idea that the brain can actively change and rewire itself. I love this concept.
It's absolutely crucial here. Dr. Dinesh discusses something called hearing aid acclimatization. When you put a hearing aid on a sudden hearing loss patient, it's not an instant fix. It's not like putting on glasses where everything is suddenly 20/20. The brain has been deprived of input. It needs time to reorganize.
So it's kind of like physical therapy for the brain.
Exactly. The source mentions studies using auditory evoked magnetic fields. They can actually scan the brain and see the activity in the association areas actively changing over time. The hearing aid acts as a catalyst. It forces the brain to rewire itself to process these new amplified signals.
So even if the ear organ itself, the physical hardware, is permanently damaged, the software up in the brain can be updated to work around it.
To a surprising degree, yes. It proves that even after a sudden traumatic loss, the neural system is still highly plastic. It's still capable of learning and adapting.
That is incredibly encouraging. It really moves the conversation from you're broken to you're adapting.
It does, and it highlights why giving up isn't the answer. Even if the initial steroid treatment doesn't restore 100% of the hearing, long-term rehabilitation through technology and time can make a massive difference in a patient's quality of life.
So we've gone from the terrifying morning silence all the way to the viral and vascular causes, the urgency of the steroid injections, and finally to the brain's amazing ability to recover.
It's a comprehensive journey, for sure, but I want to circle back to the start. If listeners take away only one thing from this deep dive, it should be the absolute urgency.
Treat it like a heart attack for the ear.
Precisely. If you or anyone you know, a parent, a partner, a friend says, I suddenly can't hear out of this ear, or my ear feels totally blocked and it just won't pop, do not wait for Monday. Do not wait to see if it gets better on its own. Go to the ER or go to an ENT immediately.
Time is hearing. I'll definitely be remembering that.
And if I can leave you with one final kind of provocative thought, it's something that really stood out to me in the education section of the source material. Dr. Dinesh explicitly lists educating the medical community as a major priority area.
Why is that? Isn't this standard day one medical knowledge?
You would hope so. But often, the very first person a patient sees isn't an audiologist or an ENT specialist. It's their primary care physician or maybe a nurse practitioner at a local urgent care. And there is a real documented risk that a busy GP might look in the ear, see no obvious infection, see no wax, and just assume it's clear fluid behind the eardrum. They might prescribe a basic decongestant and say, come back in 2 weeks.
And meanwhile, that critical 3-day window just slams shut.
Yeah.
That is terrifying.
Exactly. And the real tragedy here is that the tool to diagnose this in a standard clinic is incredibly simple. The source mentions the Weber test. It's an old 19th century test using a simple metal tuning fork. You strike it and place it right on the center of the patient's forehead. It takes 30 seconds.
And that simple vibrating fork can tell the difference.
It can immediately help distinguish between a conductive loss like wax or fluid, which actually makes the sound louder in the bad ear, and a sensorineural loss where the sound moves to the good ear. It really raises a thought-provoking question. How many cases of permanent deafness could be prevented if every general practitioner simply pulled out a tuning fork within that first 24-hour window?
It's such a low-tech tool for such a high-stakes diagnosis.
Yeah.
That is definitely something to mull over. It's not always about the MRI or the expensive labs. Sometimes it's just about basic clinical awareness.
Absolutely. Sometimes the old ways are still the best ways to spot an emergency.
Well, this has been a truly fascinating deep dive. I know I'm definitely going to pay more attention to my ears and my heart valves from now on.
As we all should.
Thanks for diving deep with us, everyone. Take care of your hearing, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.